almost everything will work again if you unplug it for a few minutes. Including you.
That is best-selling author Annie Lamott offering what she calls operating instructions, which, by the way, is also the title of one of her many books. That clip we just heard there, you guys, it's from her 2017 TED Talk. It's racked up more than 6 million views. It's one of those go-to TED Talks that whenever I'm feeling kind of crummy, I pop it on, and boy, does it turn the beat around. Anne is one of those authors whose fans haven't just read one or two of her books. They have read 10 or 12 of them. She's actually written 19 books in all, by the way. What readers and what I personally love about Annie and her books is that she really tells it like it is. She's open. She shares everything, even the stuff you don't want to share, the messy stuff. And while Anne is incredibly successful by any measure, her life, like so many of ours, is so full of struggle and, yeah, it's also full of pain. But Annie is on the other side of that pain, and she has this beautiful and renewed sense of optimism and purpose. And she takes what she's learned, and she shares it. In this episode, Annie lays it all out for us. She describes her childhood experiences that led to both crippling anxiety and addiction. She's a big believer in talking about those experiences, and I've learned from her transparency. I know that you will, too. But I do want to warn you, in this conversation, we really do get real. We talk about losing a parent, addiction and recovery, and finding God when you feel like you're all out of options. As you take it all in, I hope that she helps your life the way she helped mine. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Anne Lamott. I'm Hoda Kotb, and welcome to my podcast, Making Space. Annie, I love you, and I love every book you've ever written. I highlight, I cover, but I did want to ask you this. So if when you were a little girl, someone was going to come up to you and tell you, hey, little Annie, you're going to get married, but it's going to happen when you're 65. Like, what would you have thought as a kid if that were to have happened?
I would have felt complete despair. Because everything in the culture, especially in the 50s and then early 60s before the revolution, was that was the reason I had been created, was to get married and find a nice husband, probably right out of college, and then have several children and keep my weight down.
Annie, there's something about finding love at this stage in life. Yeah. I found love when I was 50, and I was like, wow, I can't believe I get to do this. Yeah. What's love like at 65?
It was always secretly a dream. You know, I know it was for you, mm-hmm. too, to find someone who is your soulmate and your partner, to have a partner in all of this, you know, sometimes fever dream of life and getting older and it all. And so when it happened, I felt like, okay, what's the catch?
I was just thinking, if you've spent your whole life, you know, having your girls, your girlfriends as your besties, was it hard to readjust your sails?
No, because I had a standard, and it was that with most of the other men I'd been with, I realized that if they had been women, they wouldn't have been my best girlfriend. You know, they wouldn't have been somebody in my really inner sanctum. And so that was my standard, that I wanted to find a man who, if he was a woman, I would have wanted to be best friends with. And that was what, in fact, I found in Neil.
Oh, my God. I love this chapter. I want to get to all the chapters of your life, but I want to start back in the beginning. And I often try to picture you as a little girl.
Yeah.
And I wonder, like, what was little Anne Lamott like?
Well, I'll send you a picture because I was a tiny sort of wood sprite. I had this crazy, curly, kinky, platinum blonde hair and these gigantic green eyes. And I was very, very, very thin. But I was a very scared child. I was very bright and very sensitive. I had an older brother and a baby, my little brother, and it turned out I needed to raise the baby because my parents were so unhappy and distracted that they probably should have raised, you know, teacup poodles or orchids instead of children. And so I took care of raising this baby, my little brother, who's now 6'4" and a very, very cherished part of my life. And I believe two things. One was that I was defective because my parents were so unhappy. It must be me. Mm-hmm. If it was me, then I had some sense of control because I could try to do better and need less. So I felt that there must be something really wrong with me. And then I also felt I was responsible for making Dad come home, and there would be trickle down. If Dad was okay, then there'd be trickle down and Mom would feel good about herself, and then we would all get nourished. So it was a very difficult dynamic for me. And I developed some survival skills that became my default landing places whenever I've been very, very stressed or overwhelmed by life. One is to think I need to do better and ideally need almost nothing, and that I'm in charge of helping everybody feel happy.
It's just such a big responsibility for a little kid. I mean, I was just thinking of all the stuff that kids have to be concerned about, but it sounds like you had all kind of grown-up problems.
I had grown-up problems, and I got migraines at 5 years old and 40 pounds. So, but back in the 50s, there wasn't a consciousness that children could have mental illness or burnout. You know, I think I had burnout because there were just a lot of balls in the air. Now, Hoda, let me ask you something. What were you like? Who was Hoda at five?
I had frizzy hair too, and I had a funny name. And I think my probably most difficult years were like my junior high years. I remember, this is weird, but I remember playing spin the bottle, and I was, you know, playing the game and you spin it. And when the bottle lands on somebody, you kiss them. And I was so hoping it was going to land on this kid named Todd. And I had my stop sign glasses and my hair and my name and all of me. We were just sitting there, and I spun the bottle. It landed on Todd, and I was so excited. And he said, "I think that's going a little too far."
Oh, my God.
I remember it like it was yesterday. It was like a knife in my soul.
Oh, yeah.
But I remember always kind of feeling in those years on the outside. So I think I turned into a pleaser, like, how can I fix this? You know, they don't like me. I'll get them to like me. Here's an example. This is so weird. But on the show about a few weeks ago, somebody walked by the window and flipped me off. And you know what I did? You're going to laugh, Annie. I was like this. Hey, I was literally trying to get the guy to like me.
I know.
I was like, he flipped you off.
I know.
Like, let it go for whatever reason. Who knows?
Well, we got addicted to people pleasing as young girls because it became one of our comfort zones.
Here's the funny thing, though. I just did that last week, trying to wave that guy into liking me.
I did it this morning. Yeah. Yeah.
We still have work to do. You know, as you go through, there are ways we get courage when we're kids. And where did you find courage when you were a kid?
Well, I got funny, you know, because I was being bullied. And my parents were atheists. They were very avant-garde. And I had this secret, deep secret that I believed that if I asked for help in the dark, something heard me. I always had this secret belief that there was some kind of love energy that heard me. Mm. And then I heard eventually that courage is fear that has said its prayers. Mm. And so when I was a little bit afraid, I just prayed, help me, help me. And then I learned, you know, do it. I learned the motto, do it afraid. You know, you take the action and the insight follows. I wrote a whole chapter on perfectionism because it's the voice of the oppressor. Mm-hmm. It's the enemy. Mm-hmm. And all through those years, all through high school, I really tried to do it all perfectly. I tried to be, and my parents encouraged that. Mm-hmm. And if I brought home a B+, they would say, this isn't a criticism, Annie, which is the great palace lie, because it obviously was. But how much harder would it have been to get an A-?
I'm so into you, probably because you just keep getting up. And I know that one of the ways that you tried to get your mojo was by having a drink. When did you have your first drink, Annie?
Well, we'd had sips because my parents were both, my mother was from England and my father was just very, very hip, slick and cool and jazz oriented. So it was believed that you could give children sips of things so they could test beer or wine and therefore be more superior to other children in WASPier families. But I remember chugging a beer, a 16-ounce Coors, when I was 12 years old, so it would have been 66, with my best friend, Lisa Campmeyer, and I felt hope bloom in my chest. I could breathe again. But I remember that first beer, and I remember thinking, I'm good. And then I believe I also had a predisposition. It is a family disease. Both my brothers ended up being alcoholics. My dad was an alcoholic, and my son was an alcoholic, an addict. And it just began to be what I loved most about life was having a couple of beers before seventh and eighth grade dances. And then I began to smoke marijuana that I then smoked until I was 32 on a daily basis. And of course, I discovered lots and lots of other drugs along the way that either helped me lose weight or get even more animated or help me get to sleep a little later.
And this went on, you said, for years, but was there a point where you were, what was the point where you were on your knees and you said, that's it, like, I can't live like this?
The funny thing about being addicted to drugs and alcohol is that you just hit bottoms every step of the way. You know, I heard a guy when I first got sober say that he began deteriorating faster than he could lower his standards. And this happened for me by like 18 or 19. I was humiliating myself. I was driving drunk and stoned. A little later when I started taking a lot of LSD and other hallucinogens, I was driving kids and teenagers around I lived in this little hippie town, and because I had such terrible self-esteem and I was addicted to people-pleasing, that if I was driving 7 miles an hour with stoned friends in the car trying to get to the ridge for the sunset and these teenagers needed a ride, I'd pick them up because I loved for them to love me and to think I was so cool. Mm. So, you know, over and over and over again, it's like you can't lower the limbo pole low enough. And I did that. I mean, I had some catastrophic public experiences and they weren't enough. And then at 32, because of grace or something, I woke up one morning after a very, very bad 3-day 4th of July holiday where I'd been in blackout for 3 nights in a row. One night on the boat watching the 4th of July fireworks at Chrissy Field, which is in the San Francisco Marina, in a rowboat with my publisher. And I don't have depression. I have a rather severe anxiety disorder. And I just kept thinking kind of calmly about climbing over the side of the boat, because I was exhausted. Oh. And sometimes grace looks like exhaustion, and it looks like running out of any more good ideas. But grace always meets you exactly where you are, and then it doesn't leave you where it found you. So on July 7th of 1986, I woke up. I was so sick, and you know, there was a 3-inch cigarette ash next to my bed. I don't know why I hadn't burned my tiny houseboat down. And I called a sober friend, and I said, okay, I might be done. Yeah.
Did you worry, Annie, that without the booze, your creativity wouldn't be there?
Yes,
did you wonder?
I was right. it took me almost a year to write again. It took me 10 months. All I could do was to get sober and stay sober. Mm-hmm. And when I got sober, I was panic-stricken because everything I knew was that the alcohol and the alcoholic community and the marijuana were what gave me my sense of creative freedom to express myself. And so all I did was get sober. And then I remember noticing little by little that it was like my windshield had gotten washed and that I could actually see things and I could remember them. One of the great things about being sober is you can remember what you did the night before when you wake up. You don't have to call around and ask people, you know, see if they're still speaking to you or how worried they are about whether or not you need to go to the hospital. And so little by little, I started to realize that the windows of my soul were getting cleaner and cleaner and cleaner. And then I started doing what I've always taught, like in Bird by Bird or when I teach writing workshops, was that you just do a little bit at a time, bird by bird, and you let yourself do it badly. And little by little, I wrote probably the best novel I ever wrote, which is called All New People, because I was an all new person.
Coming up, Anne Lamott on losing her dad at an early age and how she still makes space to grieve.
Let's talk about I know that you were in your 20s when your dad passed, and everyone deals with grief differently. My dad passed when I was a junior in college, and I remember it like it was yesterday. It was like, yeah. Wait, how did that happen? How did you deal with that passing and that grief?
Well, I drank. I was 23 when he got sick. I was already drunk every night. But as soon as he got sick, my brothers and I were just off and running. He got brain cancer. He had a metastasized melanoma in his brain. And it was up to us to help him through it and take care of it. And so how do you survive the unsurvivable? With a couple of really close friends to whom you can tell anything. And it was incredibly hard. And I actually am not positive I ever came back from it. But in every book I've ever written, I talk about how you're not going to get over certain losses. And the world tells you you will. The culture has kind of a grid of when you should be over certain losses, like 18 months on a spouse. And then we'd like to see you start participating more fully in life again. A parent, 2 years, right? A best friend, 6 months. Meh, if. A brother, 6 to 8, right? And I discovered you don't. And it's okay. You know, Carly Simon has that song, I forgot what it's called, but she says there's more room in a broken heart. And I discovered that if I didn't let my heart seal over, that my dad was really fully alive. And then when my mom passed, my mom too. And after the acuity of their loss passed, because my heart didn't seal up and I was still permeable, I could feel them again in a very real and vital way.
The heart sealing up is such a beautiful analogy because you can tell when someone's heart is hard. I mean, you can see how they look. And did you consciously say, mine's staying open, or did you just, that's Annie?
What I've discovered is that if I set the intention of staying as permeable as I can and crying and grieving and being ugly and enraged, that the person I've lost is still alive for me. And you know, this is such a cliche at this point, but there's that great line of Leonard Cohen's that there are cracks and everything, and that's how the light gets in. And so you can kind of be a birth coach for other people in deep grief and tell them the cracks are good. You're going to be so grateful for those cracks a little ways down the road.
My best friend's husband passed a couple of years ago, and she cried every day. And now she says it'll come forever, but it comes in waves. And she talked about how they're less frequent, but when they come, they're big.
Yeah.
It's like the first one.
Yeah.
And it hits you super hard. And their love story was one. They have a love story that worked as friends, as lovers, and spiritually. They had all three. Like if someone were to ask me what's a perfect love story in real life or in the movies, you know, it would be theirs. But I think that that was so profound about the waves, just like you mentioned, like you still cry about your best friend, probably your parents. And that's, you just turn that into a good thing, which I think for me, I was like, wait, why am I crying? That was so long ago.
Through love, all pain. We'll turn to medicine, becomes medicine for others, you know? And I think so much of the reason that it's so frightening for people to go through loss and grief is, first of all, we didn't get an owner's manual for it. You're supposed to just kind of get over it at some point. Mm-hmm. But the fear that if you start crying, you'll never stop. And that if you start crying, it will just wash you away like the Mississippi River. right? Instead of the truth that it will wash you right into your very self.
Wow. Wow.
One of the acronyms I really love for fear is the frantic effort to appear recovered. And that has been one of the things that it kept me all those years from becoming wild and free, and, you know, that kept me kind of gnarled and clenched up as a mother, that I needed to look like I was doing a great job, that I appeared to be, you know. And once I was given permission by other women in various forms of sobriety to just fall apart and be a mess and say to mm-hmm. them what was true about how my mothering or had gone that day, I was home. It was like I could breathe again, because you start to laugh about it, and laughter mm-hmm. is carbonated holiness, and I would get effervescent again, and I'd laugh. We would laugh till we had tears streaming down our face, comparing notes about what it was like. In Operating Instructions, a book I wrote about my son's first year, I wrote about the grief I felt about giving birth to somebody who was going to have to go through seventh and eighth grade, you know, which is for me what hell was like, and then the hell later on of being an active alcoholic and addict. You know, but another acronym I just learned for fear that I'm really living by right now is that it's everything we've talked about up till now, which is that fear expressed allows relief. And so if I call you and I say, Hoda, I hate everything today and almost everyone, and I'm just scared to death, and I feel very, very old, and my grandson's about to be a teenager, and it's an awful, scary world, and da-da-da, you wouldn't say, oh, for Pete's sake, Annie, stop. I'm right in the middle of something. You know, you wouldn't. You would probably cry for me, and you'd say, oh, honey, mm-hmm. you know what? I was there Monday, and let's just, for 2 minutes, both put our phones down and go get ourselves each a lovely cup of tea, and we're going to have a little bit of tea together. And I'm going to hold some space for you while you cry, if you want to, or I'll tell you what Monday was like for me. I was down the rabbit hole. Don't even bother trying this, the frantic effort to appear recover. This helped me, this didn't. And we'd end up laughing. And then I'd be home free, yeah.
I feel like crying right now for what you just said. Like, I have a lump in my throat.
Yeah.
I think that's it. Sometimes you realize, like, God, I had that same day Monday. Just saying that, that's so beautiful. And also, like, making space, I think that's kind of the title of this podcast. But what's funny is, when I spoke with you before, Annie, I felt that. I felt such a click with you. Let's talk about Sam. So you are in your 30s and you're pregnant. Uh-huh. Was that a joyful moment when you learned the news, or were you freaked out?
Both. You know, the culture, and certainly my parents, forgot to tell me that you could have two feelings at once and that all truth was a paradox. And I was ecstatic, literally ecstatic, and terrified. And Sam's father, to whom he eventually became very, very close as a boy, the father didn't want anything to do with me. So I was going to do it alone. His father's 6'4", and very, very, he was very angry. And he would show up places and point his finger at me and say, let me put it this way, you are not going to have this baby.
Oh, geez.
So, and I didn't have any money. I've been sober 3 years. I've been at this church for 4 years. So I had a recovery community, and the church told me that wherever God took me, he or she would be waiting there with whatever was needed. And I knew by then that courage was fear that has said its prayers. And I I had mixed feelings all the way through my pregnancy, terror that I wasn't going to be able to be a good mother, that I'm, you know, I'm like so redeemed, and I'm a really decent person, and I have really great coaching from my best friends and my mentors and whatnot. But then I'm a pretty regular screwed up person, you know. I have this anxiety disorder, and I have a little narcissism, and I have terrible self-esteem some days, and I came to believe one of the ways that to looking at God is the Jehovah Jireh, the provider. What do you need, honey? I just need a little help today. Well, I wrote a book, Help, Thanks, Wow, the Three Essential Prayers. And so that's what I did all through pregnancy was, help me, help me, help me, you know, help me. And oh my God, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. It worked. I got it. You know, I after I had the baby, friends paid the rent for me for a while. And then maybe when he was 8 or 9 months, I got a book review job at Mademoiselle. And so I had a little money coming every step of the way. I was provided for. I was trying to make a living and I was newly sober. Okay. And Sam had colic. And that was just a nightmare, really a literal nightmare, because at 5 o'clock when he was like 2 months old, it was like he'd look at his little watch and go, oh, is it 5 already? And then he'd start to sob and wail and nothing would calm him and placate him. And it would go on till 10 every night. And and so what do you do in the face? Where do you start? You said, well, with everything, with real life, with sobriety, with marriage, with having a sick parent, you start where you are, you push back your sleeves, you let yourself do it badly. And then little by little, people were teaching me things that helped the baby start doing better.
After the break, the power of surrender, how Anne Lamott let go and found hope.
You know, God is, you talk a lot, obviously, about God, and I think that is, like, that's your North Star. Is there a prayer that you repeat to yourself? Is there something that you say? And I'm asking you this because it was so funny, Annie. I was just talking to this lady, and she said, I have one prayer that I pray every day over and over and over again, and it's only about 10 words. And I said, okay. She said, are you ready? She teed it up pretty good, and she said, it always works. I said, okay. Because I was telling her I felt like I wanted to be more of service and I didn't know if I was being that. And I would look at the end of the day and wonder, like, what did I do today? And she said, okay, here's your prayer. God, I'm here and I'm available.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah.
God, I'm here and I'm available. And that really struck me in my soul. And I thought, oh my gosh, yeah. And I'm just even sitting here in this moment, I'm here and I'm available.
Yeah.
To serve. Is there something that you like, one that resonates with you?
You know, I really pray mostly to be bread for the journey for others. Mm. And for, you know, Rumi said that through love, all pain will turn to medicine. Mm. And so I pray that all this, my mistakes or my terrible thoughts or my judgment or my whatever, will be turned into medicine for others, that I can share it and that it was awful and I lost hope and I came through and I'm back in the saddle. You know, we hear stuff that changes us molecularly. And what I heard in 1986 was a very well-known, very rich and handsome guy say, I came into sobriety as a hotshot. And you all helped me work my way up to a servant. And he said, that's where I live now, because that's that's the only fulfillment.
I got chills.
Yeah.
I just got chills all over. Wow. You described yourself as you were drunk and messy, but you went to this little church. What was it about the church that kept you there? Like, what happened?
Wow, that's such a beautiful question. What happened? Well, the grace of God is spiritual WD-40. And it was a year before I got sober. It was 85. And there used to be this town of 2000 where there are 6 churches. And there was this funky little church with this Charlie Brown tree out in front. But I would hear from the flea market this music emanating. It was either gospel, you know, or it was the songs of the civil rights movement, which I'd grown up on because my parents were civil rights people, and it was Pete Seeger and the Weavers and Joan Baez and We Shall Not Be Moved and Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. And that stuff, music gets in so much deeper to our souls and to our heart cave And I just went over there. Mm. And I sat there, and I didn't want any of the Jesus part because my parents were atheists, and that would have been, you know, a nightmare for them. But the people there are only about 40 of them. They didn't hassle me. They didn't try to get me to understand anything theological. They just saw that I was damaged and deeply, deeply lonely. And they let me be. And they got me water. And I stopped running for my cute little life when the sermon came up. And little by little, I just decided to surrender. You know, everything beautiful and incredible, including my sobriety, began when I just surrendered. When you grow up with brothers, if you surrender, it means you get your face ground in the dirt. But with God and life and the love energy that surrounds us, if you surrender, you go, you know, my prayer with God, I said with enormous bitterness, I said, okay, fine, you can come in.
When you talk, I feel like there's so much beautiful furniture in the room. I'm missing some of it. It goes by so fast, but I feel like you're like a hope giver. So what gives you hope these days?
Oh, what gives me hope? You know, I wrote a book on hope called Almost Everything, and it was like almost everything gives me hope. One of my daily prayers is bless them and change me.
Bless them and change me.
Bless them and change me. And you see that you're getting a little better, and you see just how incredible people are all around you doing the best they can. Wendell Berry, who's just about my favorite poet, wrote in the Mad Farmers Liberation Front poem, he said, be joyful though you have considered all the evidence, you know? So you can have your glasses on where you're looking at the evidence and it's just grim, you know? Or you can put your good pair of glasses on and be joyful and be grateful. And as soon as you're in gratitude, you watch out, world, because gratitude is some mysterious magnetic energy that just draws goodness to you. It draws people to you. It draws wonderful new life to you. When you're grateful, you just see, you know, whatever you focus on, you get more of. So you get grateful, you get more grateful, you get more blown away by the beauty of it all.
Anne Lamott, that was so beautiful. I am inspired. Your books, every single one of them, I dog ear and highlight. I've ruined most of your books and I like them that way. I gave out Help Thinks Wow for Christmas to all my friends 1 year, and each year I wait for a new one. So I know you keep churning them out. But Annie, I love you so much. Thank you for being on my podcast, and I look forward to what's next.
Hoda, I love you so much too. Thank you.
Oh,
God bless you. Good.
God bless you. That was awesome. Hey guys, thanks so much for listening and going on this journey with me. If you like what you've heard, and I sure hope you do, please give Making Space a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. And be sure to tell your friends and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. Making Space with Hoda Kotb is produced by Allison Berger and Ursula Summer, along with associate producer Olivia Ruchard and audio engineer Bob Mallory. Original music by John Estes. Bryson Barnes is our technical director. Minika Thoria is our executive producer. Soraya Gage is our general manager. And Madeline Herringer is our head of editorial.